can be a mechanism where someone comes in to take control of that corporation, to acquire it, and puts new management in place and empowers them to make key strategic changes to manage the company more effectively. Think of hostile takeovers as bringing governance economies to a firm that's been acquired that hasn't been governed or managed very effectively in recent years. Now, you'd like to be able to do this without having to do a hostile deal, right? There's some benefit from acquiring a company and having the cooperation of the people who work there. But if the people who work there are managing it poorly, you may have to execute a hostile deal to be able to take entrenched management and move them out. So if we look at InBev, a large beer company that bought Anheuser-Busch, America's leading beer company, that began as a hostile takeover. They viewed Anheuser-Busch as poorly managed, as wasting shareholder resources. So what do? They launched a hostile deal because they knew they could not get the cooperation of the Bush family and one of the Bush family members who was CEO at the time. They put a lot of pressure on the board to sell. Eventually, though, they came to a deal. And sometimes in these hostile deals, we see what's called a bear hug, where the seller, the target firm, kind of hugs the firm looking to acquire them. They say, okay, we resisted for a while, but we see the writing on the wall, and we'd rather do a friendly deal than be completely taken over in a hostile way. So not all hostile takeovers end as hostile. Some of them become a little more friendly during the course of the transaction. But ultimately, it's about bringing new management to the table and improving the performance. And InBev clearly moved top management out at Anheuser-Busch and put their own top management in to try to drive better earnings, better performance at a company with some historic brands like Budweiser. Now, one of the challenges with any deal and why many deals don't work out is that it's very difficult to actually integrate two or more companies together. You know, you look at this and you say there's obvious synergies here, but making those synergies happen, that's no easy task. And two scholars, Hospelag and Jemison, have done an interesting study of this. They looked at a number of deals and came to the conclusion that how you go about the acquisition decision-making process, how you do the due diligence, how you approach the other firm, well, that has a great impact on the ability to then integrate that company. And so they argued that if you manage the process of deciding how to acquire a firm well, it enhances the probability that you can execute the integration effectively. But too often, we see culture clashes, and we see other friction that emerges, and therefore the acquirer is not able to realize the synergies that they expected. In the Daimler-Chrysler merger, there were many flaws with the way Daimler went about making the decision to acquire Chrysler. And that had long-term negative repercussions on the ability to make the thing work. Sometimes we also see problems of integration because a firm has had a lot of experience buying small companies and now suddenly tries to do a very big deal. And the integration of a large firm is much more difficult. So Polycom, for instance, is a firm out in California who successfully acquired a number of small companies over the years. But then they acquired a very large East Coast competitor. And that turned out to be much more difficult from an integration perspective, right? The challenges associated with swallowing a large company, very different than buying a small startup in Silicon Valley. Now, finally, we have to turn to the issue of these global mega deals. Why do they occur? And is there a good logic behind them? Well, in many cases, what we hear from executives is, I think at the end of the day, that this will be a situation where there will be three big players in our industry. And so consolidation is inevitable. And I need to be at the forefront of that, and we need to execute a merger or acquisition because we want to be one of those three. Scholar Pankaj Ghemawat, an expert in international strategy, has noted that this rule of three has become conventional wisdom in many industries. Yet why three? And could three be the perfect number in every industry, from aluminum manufacturing to automobiles to retail? I mean, why three? And he's gathered a great deal of data on this issue. And here's what Ghemawat says. He says the assumption that the global economy is a winner-take-all economy has become common wisdom. But there's no evidence to support that premise. The theoretical links between the globalization of an industry and the concentration of that industry are weak. Executives, then, need to break free of the biases that lead them to pursue larger and larger deals. There are better, more profitable strategies for dealing with globalization than relentless expansion. And he's actually collected some data on this. he's seen that many industries have actually become more fragmented, not more concentrated or consolidated, as globalization has occurred. And he's actually tracked this in a number of industries, like automobiles. And he said this premise that because of globalization, there'll be three big winners at the end of the day, that the industry should become more consolidated, it hasn't held. We've actually seen the emergence of new players, particularly from emerging markets, and the industry become less consolidated over time. So he's questioned the validity of this conventional wisdom that underlies many deals. Of course, there are alternatives to doing mergers and acquisitions. You may use a joint venture as an alternative to a merger. And there are a number of reasons why you might use joint ventures to enter foreign markets. Gupta and his colleagues have done interesting research on why, and they cite five reasons. Government regulations may require foreign firms to partner with local companies when entering a market. There may be high physical, cultural, and linguistic barriers and distance between a home country and host countries. And the local unit can operate relatively autonomously from the corporate parent in other countries. And so a joint venture may make sense in that kind of situation. The partners have much to learn from each other in some cases. And that learning might be relatively balanced. And so a joint venture may be a great vehicle to learn from another company without fully merging with them. And lastly, a joint venture may make sense when a multinational doesn't have the capital, the financial resources, to expand into a foreign market on its own. And so a joint venture becomes a good vehicle for doing that. Now, there are risks with these kinds of deals, just as there are risks with mergers and acquisitions. For the multinational firm, you may lose control over your intellectual property, and you may put your brand at risk by partnering with a firm in an emerging market. That young firm in an emerging market, they want your ideas, and they may take some of them, and some of your property, intellectual property that's so valuable to you. And they may do things that damage your brand. But for the emerging market firm, they may grow too dependent on the multinational and not build their own capabilities and their own brand enough. So there's risk for them too. So joint ventures are an alternative to mergers and acquisitions, but they're not a perfect solution either. Why do some companies stick with deals that aren't making sense? Why do they not divest? Here comes the sunk cost effect again. People throw good money after bad. They can't cut their losses, and they pour more money in trying to turn it around. Research, interestingly, shows that many divestitures occur when a new CEO takes charge. So the interesting research here shows that previous CEO who made the deal typically doesn't want to divest, and so he keeps the business and throws more money in. But when a new CEO comes on board, they're not beholden to those sunk costs, and they're able to sell. Daimler sold Chrysler when a new CEO took over. So what are the lessons here? Mergers and acquisitions are difficult to make work, and many firms overpay for various reasons. There are some good motives, but can you get the deal done at the right price? And the right motives aren't always in place. Integration, too, is a key challenge. In short, it pays to be skeptical about the possible benefits from any deal, given the history of failed deals that we know about. So what's your assignment for this lecture? Find news of a recent merger or acquisition. Try to determine the premium that the acquirer has paid for that target firm. And then examine management's explanation of the synergies they expect from the deal. Do you think they can achieve those synergies? Can they justify the premium that they've paid? And then, what's happened to the stock of the acquiring firm? Do investors believe that the deal makes sense? And do you agree with them?
This lecture is titled, Launching a Lean Startup.
In this final lecture on competitive strategy, I would like to take a look at the challenge of launching your own business. Many of you would like to be an entrepreneur at some point in your career. You have an idea for a new product or service, and you'd love to run your own venture, to be your own boss. How can we apply the ideas from this course to helping you build and run a successful venture? And how is entrepreneurship different than leading a complex, large organization? Let me start with an interesting and fun exercise that I run with many executives at many companies around the world. It's called the Marshmallow Challenge, designed by a man named Peter Skillman, who used to work for IDEO, one of the world's leading product design firms. and executed by Tom Wujek, a designer, with many groups of people from different fields and domains around the world. I'd like to tell you about this challenge, this exercise, and the results from Wujek running it in many different companies and organizations and different fields of expertise, and what he's found about how different people perform at very different levels on this exercise. It's called the Marshmallow Challenge. What do you ask small groups of people to do in the Marshmallow Challenge? You give them some materials and ask them to build the tallest freestanding structure in 18 minutes. What materials do you give them? Well, you give them 20 strands of spaghetti, uncooked, of course. You give them some masking tape and some string, and you give them a single marshmallow, the kind you might roast with your kids over a campfire in the summer. Now, there are a few rules with regard to how they should go about building this freestanding structure. First and foremost, the entire marshmallow must be on top of the structure. You cannot split, break, or cut the marshmallow, and it cannot be anywhere but the top of the structure. You don't have to use all of the materials that have been given to your team, and you may break the spaghetti. You also may cut the tape and the string for use in your structure however you like. There's a few other rules as well. You cannot move the table or other structure that you're building upon. And you cannot hang the structure in any way from the ceiling. It has to be freestanding. The way I run it, I allow people to tape materials to the top of the table, but to no other surface, not the bottom of the table or any chairs nearby or anything like that. And I don't allow anyone to use any outside materials during the challenge. Finally, the team has to let go of the structure when the buzzer goes off, when time runs out. Typically, I find that even senior leaders of large corporations have a blast running this challenge. I've done it in many different settings, from large Fortune 500 companies to small startups. I've done it with 800 students in a gymnasium at Bryant University, where I teach. It's a fascinating and fun exercise, but it has some deep lessons about entrepreneurship that are important for anyone choosing to launch their own venture. So what do the results show? There's a great TED Talk by Tom Wujek, the designer who's run this challenge many times with different groups of people. And what has he found? Well, who performs really poorly on this marshmallow challenge? It turns out recent graduates of business school underperform the average. It's pretty interesting. Lawyers don't do very well on it either. CEOs, they do a little better than average, but not spectacularly. Who excels? Well, it turns out kindergarten students do great on this challenge. So do engineers and architects. Now, Wujek points out, thankfully, engineers and architects do well in this challenge. After all, they're designing buildings every day. But why do kindergarten students do so well and business school graduates do so poorly? And that's something that he explains by looking at how business school students, graduates, and executives, how do they think? How do they go about their work versus a kindergarten student? Well, you're taught in business school to plan and then execute. You develop a clear concept of what you're trying to achieve. You set out your goals and your means of achieving those goals, and you detail that out as much as possible. In the case of the Marshmallow Challenge, that means coming up on paper with the perfect design and talking through its strengths and weaknesses and debating them with other team members. And then you move to execution. Once you've got your perfect design, you start to build your tower. That's the simple plan, execute model, the very linear model that many people pursue when they're trying to achieve this challenge. But what does the kindergarten student do? The kindergarten student tends to pick up the marshmallow very early on, and they start to play with it and try different things. You see a lot of trial and error with the kindergarten student groups, the kind of trial and error that adults don't engage in. Now, why is trial and error so important? Well, if you look at what happens with executives when they do this, or business school graduates, I've watched and noticed that many of them don't even touch the marshmallow until the 16 or 17 minute mark. So they design, they argue over the design, they sketch it out, they build, and then they pick up the marshmallow. And it turns out they've assumed a marshmallow is very light. But with a tower of spaghetti, tape, and string, a marshmallow is quite heavy, and their tower tips over. Now, the kindergarten students don't run into that problem. Why? They've been experimenting with the marshmallow all along. They've been doing what great designers and great entrepreneurs do. They've been testing, experimenting, and prototyping. So instead of a linear process of planning and executing, they're coming up with a very rough concept and they're trying it out. They're building a crude prototype or test. They're playing with the marshmallow. They're getting a sense for how heavy it is and what kind of a structure might hold it up. And then they're adapting and they're changing their structure. They're changing their prototype. Maybe they're scrapping it entirely if their initial structure doesn't work at all. So the kindergarten students are engaging in the kind of rapid prototyping that great entrepreneurs and great designers do. Now, it's interesting. In his results, Wujcik finds that CEOs do better when an executive admin, an administrative assistant, joins their team. Why is that? And he argues, his hypothesis is that those administrative assistants, they are particularly attuned to watch carefully the work process. And they're very good at facilitating the work process. So they get the team to work together more effectively. And they help them through a testing and prototyping type process that leads to a higher structure. So we see this interesting disparity between those who go about planning and executing versus those that test and prototype. What does that have to do with entrepreneurship and business strategy? Well, as Peter Skillman, who founded this challenge, who created it, once said, he said, enlightened trial and error succeeds over the planning of the lone genius. And this is true not just in the marshmallow challenge, but in launching a new venture. So if we think about how we typically launched entrepreneurial ventures in the past, well, the old way was to conduct extensive market research, to build a detailed business plan, perhaps more than 100 pages. And within that, to clearly build detailed pro forma financial statements, forecasts of exactly the revenues and the expenses you expected in the outgoing years. Is there a different way to launch a new venture? Well, in recent years, there's been a movement called the Lean Startup. It's a new way to launch a venture. It's different than the old sort of planning and executing model. It's more iterative, it's less linear, and it involves more adaptation and learning so as to get the strategy right, not the first time, but as quickly as possible so you can succeed in the marketplace. Eric Ries is one of the pioneers of this lean startup methodology, and he articulates it as follows. He says the lean startup methodology has as a premise that every startup is a grand experiment that attempts to answer a question. The question is not, can this product be built? Instead, the questions are, should this product be built? And can we build a sustainable business around this set of products and services? This experiment, he says, is more than just theoretical inquiry. It's a first product. If it's successful, it allows a manager to get started with his or her campaign, enlisting early adopters, adding employees to each further experiment or iteration, and eventually starting to build a product. That's the lean startup philosophy. Now notice there's an important distinction between that approach and what happens to many entrepreneurs. Many entrepreneurs have a great technological solution. They have a product in mind. But Ries points out that a great technology or a great product concept does not a business make. You need a business model. You need to know what customers actually need this and what does the customer actually need out of that product. You can't fall in love with your own idea, and so you have to adapt. And that adaptation can be difficult for many entrepreneurs. So, he articulates this notion of an MVP, a minimum viable product. So you start by figuring out what problem needs to be solved. What pain point is there that the customer is experiencing? Not what's your idea for a great new technology, but what does the customer need based on the frustrations they're experiencing with current products and services. And then, Ries is arguing that we develop a minimum viable product, his MVP. What is that? He says the minimum viable product is that version of a new product or service which allows a team to collect the maximum amount of validated learning with the least effort. The notion here is begin to learn as soon as possible and then adapt. Entrepreneurs now talk about the pivot. You pivot or adapt, you shift your idea based on the learning that takes place. Now what's crucial here is that you get to that learning as soon as possible. That you not belabor the planning process. You don't spend years writing the 100-page business plan before you execute. In other words, You gotta pick up the marshmallow quickly, early. And picking up the marshmallow means getting an initial concept, prototype, product out into customers' hands and collecting feedback. And not spending all your time building spreadsheets to project revenues and expenses for something, frankly, that it's going to be very hard to estimate and to understand in advance. So let's get it out there and let's collect real user feedback and let's build upon that. Let's get our MVP into the customer's hands as soon as possible. Now, what are you trying to accomplish with this MVP? Rees argues you're trying to test certain hypotheses. This scientific method that he's advocating, what does that mean to test hypotheses? Well, he says there are certain kinds of propositions that you want to collect information about, certain hypotheses that you could articulate before you put that prototype in the hands of customers. What kinds of hypotheses? You might say the customer cares about XYZ. The customer defines quality as such. The customer is willing or not willing to pay this certain amount for this product or service. Those are hypotheses. You have hypotheses about what the customer needs, what they define as quality, and what they're willing to pay for. And now what do? You test those hypotheses. You begin to collect data to see, okay, this may be a great product, but can we command a price sufficient to cover our expenses? That's a very different question. You may have a great technology, but no one's willing to pay enough for you to be able to sell it at a profit. Now, getting this prototype into people's hands means getting comfortable with good enough. What do I mean by that? Good enough. Well, you can't hold the prototype forever trying to perfect it. You have to be able to get it into people's hands early, even if it's imperfect. It's got to be good enough, not perfect. But how do you know what's good enough? That's a really difficult test for an entrepreneur. And many entrepreneurs, they don't want to release their baby before it's perfect. The way I like to describe this is that, you know, if you're a parent and you have your firstborn child and you're going to go to church for the first time with this baby, you're going to do a lot to prepare for that first venture out of the house. You're going to bathe the baby and you're going to pick out a beautiful outfit and you're going to, if they have hair, you're going to begin to comb that little bit of hair they have and maybe put some baby lotion on them and you put their nice new patent leather shoes on and you take them out in a beautiful blanket so they stay warm. What's the fear for every couple who has a new baby for the first time, having three children? I know the fear. You don't want anyone to call your baby ugly. But what do great entrepreneurs do? They're willing to allow others to call their baby ugly. In other words, they're willing to put out a product that isn't perfect. And they're willing to let people say what's not perfect about it and quickly adapt, not fall in love with their idea. And the problem with many entrepreneurs is they're not listening. Even if they put out that prototype, they're hell-bent on getting their idea to market. And they've worked on it so hard, they're so passionate about their idea, they don't want to listen to feedback. So it's not enough to just get the prototype out there. You also have to be willing to listen and understand that it's not perfect and take the criticism, as harsh as it may be. It's difficult to do. Now contrast this with strategy making in large firms. If the right strategy for building a new venture is to get good enough out in the marketplace, to build prototypes, collect feedback, to use an MVP strategy, can large organizations do that? I would argue that many large organizations cannot. It's difficult for them to put a good enough product out in the marketplace. Why? Well, they've been trained to work to get something that's precise out there, to have high quality standards. They've been intent on protecting their brand throughout their existence. So to put a product out there that's imperfect, it runs the risk of harming the brand, of damaging their reputation for quality. They run the risk of being criticized by fellow managers or by their boss for having something that's getting negative feedback from customers. So typically when we work in a large organization, it's difficult to follow a lean startup methodology. But entrepreneurs can do it. They have less to lose. They're not worried about an existing brand. They're not worried about what their boss may think of them. So they can build that prototype and they can be okay with failure. But it takes an open mind. It takes an entrepreneur who's willing to not fall in love with their idea and who's willing to take feedback. And not every entrepreneur is willing to do that. David Kelly is the founder of the leading product design firm, IDEO. And he has a wonderful phrase that he's instilled at his firm to drive the innovation process. And he talks about the notion of failing often to succeed sooner. And this is really crucial in the context of entrepreneurship. You have to be willing to put something out there that is, quote, a failure, that will perhaps be trashed by customers, that will receive a lot of negative feedback. You got to be okay with that, and you have to pick yourself up, take the feedback, and adapt. Again, you see why large companies have a difficult problem with this. Large companies are averse to failure. If you're a manager at a large company and you're trying to get a new product out into the marketplace and your initial attempt is a failure, you run the risk of really harming your career, of not getting promoted, or worse. And so there's great risk aversion on the part of managers in larger organizations. They're not ready to accept failure. And the culture of large organizations is such that they're not tolerant of those early failures that are simply part of the new venture creation process. So larger companies, if they're going to plot innovative strategies for the future and bring new products and services to market, they have to become a little more tolerant of failure. Not all failures. We don't want the billion-dollar bet that's a terrible bet and that leads to huge losses. What we'd like to see is small bets, experiments, tests, prototypes. Those kinds of efforts, if they fail, are not very expensive and allow us to learn effectively. So there's a difference between the entrepreneur who raises a ton of capital and puts out a product and spends a ton of money versus the entrepreneur or the person in a big firm trying to launch a new venture who runs small experiments, cheap, inexpensive, fast prototypes to get feedback and to improve. Not all failure is acceptable. Do we have some examples of successful pivots, of companies that started out with one direction and one strategy and adapted based on customer feedback, that got their MVP out there in the market and that saw what users wanted, how they reacted, what they liked and disliked, and generated improvements? Well, it's interesting to look at three firms that really moved pretty significantly from their roots in the early stages of the strategy creation and adaptation process. Let's take Yelp. Yelp started out as an automated system for emailing recommendation requests to friends. What has it become? It's an online review system for restaurants and local businesses. Many people have a Yelp app on their phone, and if they're in a city they're not familiar with, they quickly turn to Yelp to find nearby restaurants or other local businesses, and they look to what others are saying about those businesses before they go give them their dollars. How about Twitter? Twitter, of course, is a very successful social media platform today. But did they start out that way? They did not. They were a podcasting startup in their initial incarnation, but they adapted. And how about a firm that we all know and many people love? Some maybe not, but Starbucks is a very successful company. But did they start out with the strategy that we see today? They did not. They started off selling coffee beans and espresso machines. They've become a cafe that sells brewed coffee and coffee drinks of various kinds. They evolved. Howard Schultz and the team that led them in the early days, they watched what users wanted. They listened to their customer. They interacted with them. They tried things in some of those early stores. And from that initial feedback, they adapted. They still sell coffee beans, after all. But they realized that people wanted brewed coffee and drinks of various kinds. They didn't just want to buy beans that they could then grind and brew at home. They pivoted, and that's what great entrepreneurs do. So there's an interesting question. Are lean startups more possible today than in the past? In other words, could it be that it's easier to build an MVP to test and prototype today than it was years ago? Well, there's an argument to be made that, in fact, it is easier, more feasible today. The cost of computer processing power has come down dramatically. There's open source software available that you can get to help launch your business. Cloud computing has changed the entire nature of computing in many companies. And access to capital and talent has fundamentally shifted. When I went to Harvard Business School as an MBA student in the early 1990s, most graduates went off to investment banking or management consulting. Very few people went directly from business school to the startup community. Today, you see many, many people going to business school and looking to directly launch a new venture. They don't want to work for a large corporation. They want to be their own boss. They have a great idea, and they'd like to try it. So the ability of startups to recruit talent, well, there's a lot of young talent that wants to work in a new company. So it's more feasible in many ways to launch a lean startup today than in the past. Vivek Wadha has done some interesting research over the years on startups, in particular looking at many of them in Silicon Valley. He's noted that today's laptops have the same processing power as the mini computers that cost millions of dollars in the 1980s. For storage, you once needed server farms and racks of hard disks. Today, you have cloud computing and cloud storage, and they're cheap. In short, you can run an experiment. You can get an MVP off the ground. You can launch a new venture, and you don't need tons of capital. As entrepreneurs like to say, you can rely on fools, friends, and family to get your money, and you can get a business off the ground. You don't necessarily need venture capital or angel investors at the beginning for many businesses. That's how inexpensive it's become. Now, there are organizations that help entrepreneurs, and there's a lot of controversy that's emerged as to whether or not these organizations are helpful or not. We call these startup accelerators, and there's been an explosion of the number of startup accelerators around the world. They help entrepreneurs get their new ventures off the ground. Here's how it works. They take applications. Typically, a startup accelerator is a group of experienced entrepreneurs or venture capitalists who are there to help coach and help work with entrepreneurs who want to get their new venture off the ground. They recruit them. They take applications from people who have a new venture idea, maybe have a team that started to come together and who wants some help. And they screen the applications. And what they do is accept certain new ventures into a cohort-based residential program. A venture team, a couple of partners who have an idea, would go to the location of that startup accelerator, and they would reside there for 12 weeks, and they would get some office space. They would get assistance, counseling, and a little bit of seed funding. In return, they typically would give up a 6% equity stake to the owners of this startup accelerator. And then they would work. They would work on their deal every day, on their venture, and they would get help. Not just from the people running the startup accelerator, but from a wide range of experienced capital providers and entrepreneurs in the local community. People that we call mentors in these startup accelerators, who are willing to donate their time and effort, in part because they want to help young entrepreneurs, and in part because they want early access to great new ideas that they might invest in. And so there's an opportunity at these accelerators to learn from other entrepreneurs. And ultimately, the 12 weeks culminates in what's called the demo day, where potential investors are assembled, and each entrepreneur gets a chance to pitch their idea and potentially raise funding. Now, this sounds like a great way to foster new ventures and to help sharpen the strategy for someone who may not have a lot of experience but has a great idea. But the question has emerged, is there a startup accelerator bubble? They've emerged in every city around the globe, it seems like. Can they all really have enough experience to mentor appropriately? Are they all giving good advice and counsel? Can they do the coaching that's necessary? Or are they taking equity stakes and not giving enough in return? Some of these are very successful. I did a case study recently on BetaSpring, who's been rated by academics who study startup accelerators as one of the best startup accelerators in the country. They're based in Providence, Rhode Island. Of course, we've also heard of some very famous ones like Y Combinator and Techstars. And they've had some very successful exits, i.e. companies that have gone on to achieve great valuations and raised great capital. But not all of them have succeeded. So this is one way to get help if you're an entrepreneur. But there are others as well. Increasingly, there are more and more resources out there, some of them free, to help you if you want to launch a new venture. But what's going to compel people to invest in your new venture? Well, venture capitalists often say that they invest in the team, not just the product or the idea. What does that mean? It means they're evaluating the capabilities of that top team, the backgrounds, the expertise, the way they think those people are working together. Why are they focused on the team and not just the idea? Because those investors, they know that most ventures will have to pivot multiple times in the early days. In short, the idea won't be right the first time. Like Twitter, like Starbucks, like Yelp, there'll be real adaptation that has to take place. So let's not bet on the idea in and of itself. Let's bet on the team. Is that team open enough to new ideas? Will they listen to feedback? Are they willing to put an MVP out there and then adapt? And so venture capitalists are becoming better at being able to understand whether or not this initial approach will work, whether the team is capable of adapting and pivoting as necessary. And remember, investors are more than funds providers. They can be great mentors too. And as an entrepreneur, you're not just looking for capital. You're looking for advice and counsel. And that's important as you're searching for money, to think about who can help you, not just who can provide you the funds to get your venture off the ground. Now, there's been some interesting work by Bergstone and Murphy on what they call breakthrough entrepreneurship. And they argue, at the basic level, people typically spend money on two things. First, they readily spend money to combat pain. Second, they spend money to pursue pleasure. So they argue, can you describe the pain your company solves and why anyone should care in just a few words? Can you then persuade a prospective customer to spend money to purchase your product using your simple explanation? This is really important, that you not just think about the technology or the product, but you articulate what pain you are alleviating. How are you helping the customer? And even more than that, do you have a business model, not just a product? What do I mean by having a business model? Well, what have we learned in this course? We've learned that competitive advantage doesn't come from just having the best technology or being the first mover in the marketplace. It comes from having an integrated system of activities that delivers value to the customer, enough value that you can generate returns for investors, as well as provide that consumer some surplus, some value beyond what they paid for the product. Having a great business model, it's really important. Take the iPod. It wasn't the first MP3 player out there in the market, but it was the first to put together the right business model. The iPod plus iTunes business model made for a successful new business. So in short, you have to ask yourself the question, how will you make money? Not just, do I have a great idea? Or do I have a product that I think is cool? Do users need it? Does it alleviate their pain? And do I have a business model that allows me to generate enough revenue to cover my expenses? So here are a few questions then, in summary, about launching a new venture. Number one, what customer pain point are you trying to alleviate? Number two, what is the business model that enables you to turn customer demand into profitability? Who is on your team? And what value does each person bring to your team? Number four, am I willing to adapt and pivot? Or am I falling in love with my initial idea, such that I'm not listening? And finally, where am I going to get assistance? Mentorship, connections, funding? Am I going to use an accelerator? Am I going to reach out to an angel investor? Am I going to go to a school and get the help of professors? Where am I going to get help to get my venture off the ground? So finally, the key question, of course, as we've learned throughout this lecture series, is what makes you different? Ultimately, strategy comes down to being different. You have to ask the question, what makes you different or unique? Can you sustain that positioning? Can you build a moat around your castle such that new players cannot imitate you and even surpass you? And are you making the tough choices? Are you trying to be all things to all people? Or are you making trade-offs? Are you very clear about who your target market is and who it isn't? And are you willing to say no to certain things that all your competitors are doing because you're going to take a different path? Are you willing to stand firm on that even when others, including your customers, ask you to do those things? Are you all things to all people? Or are you tailoring what you do to deliver excellence to a certain segment of customers that you're trying to please the most? In closing, I'd like to give you one final assignment. Do you have a business idea that you'd like to pursue, a new venture you'd like to get off the ground? What customer need or pain point does it address? How would you test that idea in an inexpensive way, very quickly? What experiment would you run? And what might the MVP look like for your idea? In closing, I'd like to thank you for listening to this lecture series. I hope you found it helpful. I hope you can apply these ideas in your own businesses, whether it's a large organization or a new venture. You've learned, I hope, that great firms make trade-offs, that they make those tough choices, and they build an integrated system of activities and try to sustain that advantage by scanning constantly for new threats, whether from imitators or substitutes. But most of all, we have to remember, it's really difficult to stay on top. It's hard to sustain advantage. Many firms we've seen have stumbled badly, and many of the leaders today, as I deliver these lectures, They won't be leaders tomorrow. So we have to be constantly attuned to where new rivals will come from and entrants may come in to challenge our position. But hopefully, with the ideas in this course, you'll be ready to take on those battles, to build advantage and defend that advantage in your business. Thank you.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled Critical Business Skills, Operations. Your lecturer is Dr. Thomas J. Goolsbee. Dr. Goolsbee is the Harry T. Manjurian Jr. Foundation Professor of Business and Professor of Logistics at The Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business. He also serves as Associate Director of the college's Center for Operational Excellence. He holds a Ph.D. in Marketing and Logistics from Michigan State University. Dr. Goolsbee has published more than 50 articles in academic and professional journals and has won numerous awards for his writing and research. His books include Global Macro Trends and Their Impact on Supply Chain Management, Strategies for Gaining Competitive Advantage, and Lean Six Sigma Logistics, Strategic Development to Operational Success. This lecture is titled, The Power of Superior Operations.
Apple CEO Tim Cook takes the stage to the roar of an adoring mob of fans and media, as the pop of 1,000 flashbulbs adds glitter to the dreamlike scene. Cook teases the crowd with a story just to build a little anticipation. And when he finally unveils the latest Apple gadget, the crowd erupts with raucous excitement. The market reaction is enthusiastic, too. People line up for days to get their hands on the new device. And it quickly becomes the sales leader in its product category because it defines the category. How does Apple do it? What goes on behind the scenes to make such wild success possible? A big part of the answer is smart operations. Operations is the business activity that enables companies to keep the promises they make to their customers. It includes the sourcing of materials and goods, the conversion of those inputs into something that someone else wants to buy, and the delivery of those goods. Quite simply, it's how great ideas get turned into great products and services that a customer can purchase. And operations management is the discipline of getting the most out of a company's people, processes, and technologies. Time and again, at least as of this lecture, Apple has proven itself better and faster at taking ideas from the mind to the market than its competition. But organizations of all kinds and sizes have achieved excellence in operations. And operations is not just for manufacturers. Amazon.com, Southwest Airlines, Disney theme parks, FedEx, Starbucks, Mayo Clinic, and Meals on Wheels all owe a significant part of their fame and fortunes to superior operations. What they all know is that to build and keep loyal customers, you need operations that are strategically designed and soundly executed. In this course, we'll explore the fundamental aspects of operations and operations management that organizations use to translate cool ideas into winning businesses. We'll cover essential topics like inventory management, supply management, distribution, and performance measurement. We'll also take a close look at how companies are competing through supply chain management and examine the latest trends and research on business strategies that enhance agility, resilience, and sustainability. We'll consider how companies can leverage internal as well as external resources in order to survive and thrive. To understand the true role of operations in an organization, you need to know where it fits into the big picture of business decision-making.
Even great operations companies don't ordinarily lead with an operations strategy. Rather, they begin with an overall vision or mission that drives all their functional strategies, including operations. Succinctly, the vision is the statement of who we want to be, how we want to be known and sought in the marketplace. Functional strategies then establish how we intend to get there, to live up to the promise of the vision. The first thing that companies typically do after establishing a vision is to create a market strategy, consisting of the image they want to portray in the market. The image requires supporting messaging to the target markets they want to serve. Operation strategy usually is regarded as a supporting strategy for the marketing strategy. Depending on how you want to be viewed in the marketplace, you'll formulate operations to support that vision. Harvard professor Michael Porter has identified three competitive market strategies from which a business might choose. The first is a low-cost strategy. Companies employing a low-cost strategy seek to win business by having products and services that reflect a price advantage. These products and services are considered of sufficient quality to warrant consideration, but are ultimately chosen because they represent good value in the eyes of customers. Walmart is known for employing an everyday low-price strategy that reflects this orientation. Little Caesars pizza motto suggests that you can buy two Little Caesars pizzas for the same price as one pizza at a competitor. Now, I think we'll agree that Walmart and Little Caesars don't represent prestige, but that's not what they're going after. In both cases, they're selling value, and narrow margins can be overcome by high sales volume, moving a lot of merchandise. A second market strategy involves differentiation. Here, companies seek to distinguish themselves on merits other than low price. In fact, they try to garner premium prices in light of the uniqueness of their products and services. German car makers like BMW, Mercedes, and Porsche seek to distance themselves from competitors based on higher levels of comfort, performance, and aesthetics, such that a premium price is justified in the market. Here, prestige is an important part of the value proposition. Differentiation is usually the preferred strategy to low cost. Why? Because differentiation tends to result in healthier and more sustainable margins. If you can gain recognition as offering something unique, you're more likely to enjoy a following of customers willing to pay a little more to enjoy those distinct benefits. And those customers are less likely to be swayed by competitors that offer a low price. Given global competition for products, maintaining a price advantage can be fleeting today. The third market strategy, identified by Professor Porter, is a combination of the first two. It suggests that perhaps it's possible to compete on value differentiation and low cost. This combination is quite rare, though. Some even describe it as a unicorn strategy, something talked about but never seen. I'd argue, though, that Southwest Airlines implements this strategy really well. They offer low prices on air travel, yet perform very high on key operational aspects like on-time service and customer care. They also have flight crews with good senses of humor, which doesn't hurt. So, once one of these three competitive market strategies is chosen, you must think about how to execute, devising an operation strategy that supports the vision and market strategy. Again, it's really important for your operation strategy to match the competitive market strategy. Buying premium supplies or investing heavily in operations geared toward unique customer outcomes while trying to compete on price, that just won't work. You'll spend your way right out of business. Using low-cost standard commodity materials while trying to persuade customers to pay for a customized experience, well, that won't work either. Another consideration in the selection of operation strategy is the age of the business. where it finds itself in the business life cycle. Businesses in their infancy usually start with a singular or limited number of products and services. The size and geography of the market is usually small at the outset of the business, too. It's rare for an upstart company to truly take on the world. Rather, we try to take on our little corner of the world in hopes that we can grow with the expanding range of the market. Then neighboring markets hear about the great things we're doing and ask us to move on in. Or we think the product or service format would work elsewhere, and we take the initiative to another market to expand our footprint. A resounding example of this kind of growth is Starbucks. Starting from a single coffee shop in Seattle in 1971, the company today operates more than 18,000 stores in 62 different countries. Now, that didn't happen overnight, though it might seem that way to the casual observer. The point here is that when the business is focused on a few products or services in a small geographic market, a single operation strategy usually suffices. But as the business grows in size and complexity, multiple strategies might be employed at once. And they may need to change from time to time. While Starbucks is known for its premium coffee served expertly by skilled baristas, the company also now sells prepared juices, food products, and music CDs that are complements to the focal product, the coffee. The operational strategy employed on these complementary items can be different than with the coffee. Coffee is what sets the company apart, so a differentiated strategy is used here. But the items under the glass counter are more commodity. You can find them in several other shops and stores, forcing Starbucks to be somewhat more sensitive to price on these goods. Another example of how operation strategies can expand and change over time is found in the auto industry. Toyota, among the world's largest automakers, is known for producing high-quality, reliable cars at very competitive prices. Yet in 1989, they decided to also compete in the high-end luxury market by introducing the Lexus brand. The operations employed to produce Lexus cars were different from those used to make the mainline Toyota products. For instance, it was not until recently that the company produced Lexus vehicles in locations outside of Japan. For nearly two decades, the company maintained such tight controls on the assembly of the premium cars and SUVs that they would not build them anywhere else, despite the fact that cars sporting the Toyota badge were produced in more than a dozen different countries. Over time, production capabilities in the U.S. and Canada have risen to the point where not only does Toyota produce Lexus cars there for the North American markets, but they export them to locations around the world. This reflects a change in operation strategy tied to growing markets and rising capabilities. So what are the operational differences between a company employing a low-cost strategy and one that competes on differentiated products? Let's start with the low-cost scenario. In competitive markets, low-cost usually translates into low prices. Low-cost competitors often find themselves in a race to the bottom. The combination of global competition and the internet has sped up this race. By providing a greater array of competing options and transparency on prices for goods and services in different markets, that makes price advantages fleeting. When competing based on price alone, Charles Darwin's theories of population ecology come to mind. Only the strong and adaptable parties survive. It's not a place for the faint of heart. If you lay down the challenge of price competitiveness, you essentially try to kill off everyone else, and you become the target that other low-cost providers seek to kill off. At least with differentiation strategies, you usually have multiple ways to set yourself apart. With low-cost, it comes down to this one criterion, price. Commodities like those found in agricultural and construction trades commonly compete like this. As I mentioned earlier, one alternative is to pursue a hybrid strategy. competing on a combination of value differentiation and low cost. It's a tough thing to pull off, but one thing that allows Southwest Airlines to do it is that they don't provide service everywhere in the United States. They're not trying to serve every little town and city through the hub and spoke systems employed by most of their competitors. Instead, they're selective. Cities actually market themselves to Southwest in hopes of landing their services. Back in the late 1990s, the city leaders of Des Moines, Iowa, attempted to recruit Southwest Airlines to the Midwestern city. Southwest saw the proposal and passed. They did enter the market some years later, but they do business where they choose, and they keep their costs in check through strategic operations. For instance, they use only a single model of aircraft, the Boeing 737, for all of their services. This allows for standardization in spare parts and in their maintenance operations. Also, their pilots must only be certified to fly this one aircraft, making their pilots more interchangeable too. And no first-class service is offered. So the picture of differentiation here is not achieved through fanciful offerings or doing things vastly differently from the competition. It comes by way of limiting the company's focus and executing very well. The same might be said of boutique grocery retailer Trader Joe's. Rather than stocking 120,000 different items like a typical Walmart store, a Trader Joe's store stocks about 4,000 different items, 80% of which are private brands sold exclusively there. In total, Trader Joe's offers a unique yet limited assortment of products that helps to keep prices affordable, right down to the extremely affordable Charles Schall wines, known affectionately as Two Buck Chuck, which as of this taping retails for $2.49. The examples of Southwest Airlines and Trader Joe's show a collaboration between each company's business and operations strategies. Now, while you can choose an operation strategy that suits your overall business strategy, at some point, you have to execute. So let's turn our attention to operational capabilities, which is the composite of processes, people, and technology employed to execute your operation strategy. Processes define what you do. All work is conducted in processes. And today we spend a great deal of time studying processes with techniques offered by improvement methods like lean thinking and Six Sigma. Let me give you a brief synopsis of each of these methods. Lean thinking is dedicated to eliminating waste from processes. By mapping processes, we capture the steps involved in doing our work. Some steps are what we call value-added, meaning that the customer cares about these activities and is willing to pay for these aspects of the work. Value-added steps usually change the appearance of a product or its performance in some way that's noticeable to the customer. All other steps are considered non-value-added and should be reduced or even eliminated from the process. A leaned-out process is one that has wrung out the waste, leaving only the value-added work and essential supporting steps, like keeping the accounting books and observing rules and regulations. Lean processes provide the value that customers seek and do it in less time with fewer resources. A company that we've already discussed in this lecture, Toyota, serves as the inspiration for lean thinking. A major research study conducted at MIT in the 1980s uncovered something special about Toyota. By virtue of its Toyota production system, the company was able to deliver more product of higher quality with fewer plants, fewer people, and less material in less time than the competition, all amounting to lower cost. One of the research team members remarked that when you think about it, Toyota was lean, and the label stuck. The other process improvement method, Six Sigma, applies the rigor of the scientific method to work processes and is dedicated to reducing variation in those processes. When we have variation in inputs or variation in how work is performed, we can expect variation in the outputs of the process. Unwelcome variations are called defects. And defects are the enemy of consistent quality, leading to adverse customer experiences with our products and services. It was an engineer at Motorola Company, Mr. Bill Smith, who devised the Six Sigma methodology in the 1980s. What does the term Six Sigma itself refer to? Those of you who have studied statistics know that sigma is the Greek notation for standard deviation, the mathematical measure of variation. To calculate the capability for a process in terms of variation, we determine the defects per million opportunities. A defect opportunity is any action that strays from the accepted standard for delivery of a perfect product or service. This defect calculation then converts into a level of sigma performance. And the more sigmas, the narrower the variation band for the process, meaning that the process is operating within very narrow tolerances with less observed variation. And that's the goal. Bill Smith wanted Motorola to perform at a Six Sigma level, which translates to no more than 3.4 defects per million opportunities in the production of the company's electronic products. If that sounds like a really high standard of quality, well, it is. The Six Sigma method comes equipped with an array of statistical tools that help to identify the root causes of variation and guide corrective actions. Can Lean and Six Sigma be applied together, you ask? Well, sure. We call this Lean Six Sigma, or Lean Sigma for short. And what you'll find is that where there is variation in work processes, we usually find waste too. So the two methods attack the same business challenge of eliminating quality deficiencies in the pursuit of perfection. Now let's consider the people aspect of operational capabilities. Obviously, this component of capability speaks to who does the work. The so-called soft side of operations is often the hard stuff to figure out. Humans are complex creatures, and understanding what might motivate one person can be difficult enough. Figuring out how to motivate large armies of people in an operation can overwhelm even the best business leader. Allow me to offer a few considerations that factor into the critical role of people in operations. Automation and the use of robots continue to be on the rise in many operational settings, especially for highly repetitive tasks or those involving hazards. But not all work lends itself to automation. This is for two reasons. For one, automation struggles with non-standard tasks, or to recognize circumstances beyond the range that a computer program can anticipate. Artificial intelligence is closing this gap, but robots are not yet smart enough to recognize non-standard situations or to accommodate them fully. The other reason for limiting automation is simply one of preference. There are some interfaces where people simply prefer a smiling face as opposed to a screen. I have a colleague who refuses to use the automated check-in at airports, preferring instead to check in with a charming agent at the guest counter. And it's nice when it works out that way, right? That the gate agent is charming and helpful. So it seems that for the foreseeable future anyway, we'll continue to rely on people to perform many critical tasks, both behind the scenes and in interfacing with our customers. But as for who to rely on, a fundamental question that we must ask when executing an operational strategy is whether we as a company must do the work ourselves or whether we will hire others. This is referred to as insourcing when we do it ourselves or outsourcing when we hire others to act on our behalf. Outsourcing has been all the rage over the past three decades, as companies elect to focus on things that they do really well. These are called the core competencies of the company. Many companies that once manufactured products now hire outside companies to produce products on their behalf. This is true of most fashion brands and electronics companies. While they still may develop product designs and product prototypes, they do not make any of the products that bear their brand names. Some companies have pursued outsourcing with suppliers in countries with low-cost labor. This practice of offshoring was particularly common in the early 2000s. Some who offshored have since brought work back into the company when control of operations was lost or inflation drove up the cost in what was once a low-cost country. Others have continued to outsource but have elected to reshore or bring the work back to domestic suppliers. Regardless of who employs the workforce, it's essential that employees know what is expected of them, that they're trained and prepared and motivated to do the work, and that their safety is assured. The final component of operational capability that I'll address in this lecture is technology, specifically the assistance we receive from both equipment and information technology to enable higher performing processes. Technology lends great convenience and enhanced capabilities to work and everyday life, but I caution people not to let it drive strategy. Rather, seek technology as an enabler of the work processes. Business strategies that rely first on technology can be too easily duplicated by competitors and leapfrogged when a better technology comes along. Competitive advantage achieved through other aspects of capability, process, and people can be more difficult to copy. What do I mean by recommending that you use technology as an enabler of a process? I'm referring to the use of technology to help us make sense of complex situations or those laden with data and information. Decision support tools like statistical software and business analytics can help us with these problems.